I call this meeting of House Finance to order. Please let the record reflect that it is 1:38 p.m. on Monday, February 27, 2023. Present with us today are Representative Josephson, Representative Hannon, Representative Galvin, Representative Staff, Representative Flom, Representative Ortiz, Representative Cronk, Representative Tomaszewski, Co-Chair Edgman, and myself, Co-Chair Johnson. Assisting us today is our LIO moderator, Doug Bridges, and our finance secretary, Leah Frazier. This afternoon, we will begin the process of hearing the governor's appointments to boards and commissions, starting with Adam Crum, commissioner designee for the Department of Revenue. We will hear from the commissioner designee, and then we'll take time for questions at the end. Commissioner designee and also Commissioner Crum, please come forward, place yourself on the record, and you may begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Adam Crum, Commissioner Designee for the Department of Revenue. Thank you for the committee for having me here today. I'd like to give you a brief history of my background, education, work history, and my vision for the Department of Revenue. I was born and raised in Alaska, one of five siblings, growing up in a cabin in the small town of Anchor Point, which allowed for a life of outdoors, fishing, camping, hiking, and hunting. I graduated from Homer High School as valedictorian, then earned a scholarship to play football at Northwestern University. I graduated with a bachelor's degree in psychology and a focus in pre-med. After college, I returned home to Alaska and started working in my family company as a safety professional and trainer on projects around the state. This allowed me to travel and see all regions of Alaska with extensive time in the villages across the North Slope. To further my career, I pursued an advanced degree from Johns Hopkins University, graduating with a Master's of Science in Public Health. My diverse educational and professional background allowed me to work as a consultant and project lead for large oil and gas companies, pipeline companies, and transportation companies. Some of the work performed includes contract negotiations, organizational development, leadership development, and risk management. Almost a decade ago, my siblings and I purchased the family company and have grown it to include commercial construction company and many commercial real estate holdings. Being an entrepreneur with a diverse portfolio provides a lot of very real experience with banking, real estate investments, and corporate finance. You have to learn in a hurry all of the nuances of procurement, grants, corporate governance, and all the other aspects of running businesses. From this background, I have been able to develop organization and strategic expertise, putting together a history of developing high-performing teams and a positive culture. I was able to bring these skills to bear 4 years ago when Governor Dunleavy appointed me as Commissioner for the Department of Health and Social Services, the largest department by positions and budget. Suffice to say, my tenure at DHSS was not routine. Less than a month into the role, we were notified by federal partners that the Alaska Psychiatric Institute, or API, was at risk of losing its authority to operate as a hospital, so we took immediate measures by bringing in management consultants to stabilize the situation. We were granted leave to continue operating, and with focused efforts from API staff and management, they have been able to grow their census count to levels not seen in years and have had multiple successful site surveys by accrediting organizations. Then in early 2020, we were hit with a global pandemic. The next 2.5 years of all of our lives were wrapped up in dealing with COVID-19 and its after effects, supply chain disruption, the Great Resignation, long COVID, rampant inflation, and economic turmoil. Looking back on the pandemic, I am beyond proud at how Alaska responded as a state and as a people. From its inception, Governor Dunleavy stressed partnership and clear communication. And I feel like we were successful when you gauge how Alaska fared in relation to other states in a multitude of health statistics. The level of responsibility that fell to the health department was unprecedented, and we took our roles seriously. Some examples being CARES funding. This was sent to states with very little guidance from the U.S. Treasury. But we were deliberate and labored to create a defensible, fair program, partnering with many community groups such as the Alaska Community Foundation, to help pay out $50 million in relief to nonprofits across all sectors. Funds were used also for direct hospital and clinic relief, to purchase testing equipment and personal protective equipment, and to pay for modified operations at state agencies. In just over a year, we dispersed $500 million in CARES relief funding. We also set up an airport testing program that was the first in the world, and we did it in just over a week's time, and it ensured safety to Alaskans while supporting our tourism economy. We also worked with cruise ships to get them to return to Alaska in 2021. This was a coordinated effort with our federal delegation to get temporary federal law changed to allow cruise ships to come to the state, and then a focused effort from health as well as the state emergency management team to develop safety plans, communicate with local communities, and negotiate with international cruise lines on responsibilities. In the midst of this was an earnest and robust effort to reorganize the Department of Health and Social Services so it could work on system redesigns to better serve Alaskans. It took two executive orders and one full year of extensive, exhaustive stakeholder outreach. But in July 2022, we were successful in splitting DHSS into two departments, the Department of Health and the Department of Family and Community Services. This was the largest organizational structure change for state government in almost 40 years. The primary purpose of this was to have a narrower focus and span of control so systemic issues can be addressed and programs revamped for better service delivery. All of this leads to where I am now, Commissioner Designee for the Department of Revenue. The department has had quite a bit of change at the commissioner position for the past 6 years. This culminated this past fall when Governor Dunleavy was going to be without a named revenue commissioner one day after the November election. He didn't wish to name another interim that only lasted until the end of the term in December. He wanted this critical department to have stability and leadership, and he wanted someone that could step in on short notice and succeed. Based upon our level of trust and my track record, the governor offered me the position. What I bring to this role is stability and managerial expertise, and I also bring credibility, both with the public and I hope with the legislature. I also bring aptitude and adeptness, the ability to rapidly learn and employ knowledge. I've demonstrated the capacity to learn the necessary skills of any role in order to hire the right personnel and put them in position to succeed. This is evident by the statewide awards presented to me by the Alaska Chamber of Commerce and Commonwealth North in 2021. These awards are recognition of the responsive, hardworking organization I was able to build at Health and all the great work that the staff did. The Department of Revenue plays a critical role in our state by taking the primary role in collecting taxes and revenue that help fund state government, investing billions of state funds, determining eligibility and administering the permanent fund dividend, and enforcing and managing child support. The department is lucky to have a lot of experienced, dedicated staff that are truly good at their jobs. The Treasury Division has a long-tenured, well-respected director and a high-performing chief investment officer. The Division of Tax has experienced, brilliant staff that administer our complex programs. The list goes on. It's my job to support and enable these teams to perform at the highest level possible for Alaskans. In the role of Commissioner of Revenue, I'm the fiduciary of nearly $9 billion. This is a legal requirement to manage the funds for the maximum benefit of Alaskans. This entails regular investment review and risk meetings with our qualified staff, advisors, and consultants, and sharing this info with the public and the legislature. Also in this role, I sit on the boards of the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, the Alaska Industrial Development Export Authority, the Alaska Municipal Bond Bank Authority, the Alaska Retirement Management Board, and as a trustee for the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. Combined, these groups manage and invest over $100 billion. My vision is to have a renewed focus on economic development for the department. Governor Dunleavy has made this a key focus of his second term and has instructed all of the executive branch to work together on diversifying our economic base and finding ways to bring more people into the state. My goal is to use the position as Commissioner of Revenue to work on this by supporting local community economic development, by sharing the knowledge and resources we have at Revenue, and by building relationships and connecting with investment banks, financial firms, credit rating agencies, and industry leaders to sell the story of Alaska. I continue to serve because I love and I believe in this state. I want my daughter and all Alaskans to have amazing opportunities to thrive and enjoy this beautiful place well into the future.
All right. Thank you. Is there any questions from the committee? Representative Colomb.
Thank you, Chair. Through the Chair, thank you for being here. What do you see as the biggest challenge for Department of Revenue, and how would you correct it?
Thank you, through the Chair, Representative Colomb. I appreciate that question. Biggest challenge right now is making sure that we are at the right risk profile in our asset allocation when it comes to investment, as well as cybersecurity. These are two very big ongoing, I say the biggest, the two biggest, two very big important items that we have to look at. You know, when you look at the global economic market, it is in disarray, right? Inflation is still going up. The Fed is still talking about, are they going to increase rates? How many more times is that going to be, and to what level? So this is changing where overall process is. The nice thing is, when we look at from a state perspective, both at the Permanent Fund Corp as well as our investment staff and Treasury, we compare it back to our benchmarks and how is our active management doing. And while in some sectors a lot of money has been lost, they've done a good job of managing that and actually mitigating those proposed losses. And so as we look at this over time, is do we actually create exit strategies in our current fund types, or do we continue to hold the course and change our pacing? So this is something that's an active review process that requires on a quarterly basis. It's always been course for the Department of Revenue, but in the last couple of years it was kind of formalized in that we do have these quarterly meetings. There's an agenda-based item, and we actually share this publicly, the overall investment plan, using third-party consultants as to what their advice is, and here's our strategy, how do they actually weigh into that. The second item when it comes to the cybersecurity part is the ever-evolving world that we are in when it comes to that. Learned firsthand at the Department of Health the damage that can be done by a cyber attack and how it's the smallest of openings that these groups can take in. And so protecting Alaskans' data is key when it comes to both the taxpayer information that we have from our corporations as well as Alaskans' personal data that we have at the Permanent Fund Dividend Division. It's critical for us to continue to protect this. We have ongoing assessments. We just had our update by the FBI last week about ongoing threats and other things to look for. So internally, how we're combating this is we do have a chief risk officer, which the legislature provided last year, and we're looking towards this enterprise risk management system. It's an ongoing process that we're really never going to be done and say, okay, the house is finished, move on. It's how do we continue to evolve and stay ahead of that to make sure that our data is protected.
Thank you.
Thank you. We have questions from Representative Hannon, followed by Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. And just so you know, I am not blindsiding Commissioner-designee Crum with this in our one-on-one. I told him I would ask him this on the record and express my concern over him having headed up a department that was left in shambles by my analysis of our most vulnerable. And when that the largest department of the state was to be divided, I think the only criticism I ever heard from constituents or expressed was, we don't want to leave our most vulnerable behind and somehow avoid them. So the department suffered a cyber attack. We knew that there was an emergency order expiring. We knew that people were going to need redetermination or re-eligibility, yet we left 82,000 Alaskans without food benefits from October. And it was under your watch and your determination, and I've heard from the department about how they're going to repair it, but I have some of those concerns when you're in charge of our money. And many of these things you knew ahead of time, yet we never saw any leadership on how to resolve this before it became a crisis and people have been months without SNAP benefits. So you could tell me your life as commissioner during that.
Absolutely. Through the chair, Representative Hannon, thank you very much for that. This is not a situation that is taken lightly by myself, by Commissioner Hedberg, by the governor's office when it looks to it. When you look at departments and mega agencies like the Department of Health and Social Services, there is at any one time five burning fires across the board. And how do you triage that? These are vulnerable Alaskans in every capacity, whether that be heating assistance, senior benefits, the Medicaid program, food stamps, child care assistance, any name of the program, it's served by the Department of Health and Social Services. And there are pending items at all times. And so being that it's a limited leadership structure, there's only so much time in the day to address those. And you typically are moving on a rolling basis from what's our most outstanding letter of correction from our federal partners? What's a deadline we have to do? Where is our current audit process at? And so you're consistently looking on how do we do that. So that is the norm in the best of times. Piled on to what happened over the last 3.5 years between the cyber attack as well as the pandemic, it added an entire new realm to it. Because in the federal program, while we did have the $500 million in CARES relief, we've also had known the exact number, but it was billions in relief dollar programs that flowed through the department on top of the existing programs we already administer. So this includes new programs like Pandemic EBT, which is for paying back for school lunches that were missed when school was canceled. This is the Emergency Allotment SNAP benefits, which expanded the eligibility profile of Alaskans. And actually, if they're not in the system, it's done on a monthly basis and actually has to be put in manually. There's a number of other programs that had to come in like this. One of the benefits of the executive order and the restructuring of the department was knowing that we never fully, ever since the history of health and social services, got to the point where we were having manageable fires. And so part of that was making sure that we set up a departmental structure by separating out Department of Family and Community Services to where API and OCS and DJJ and Pioneer Homes have a focused approach because they're facilities-based versus the Medicaid and the public assistance side in public health, that they can be really looked at together in a holistic manner. We knew that there were holes in the system. We did not know how bad these holes were on the DPA side. There has been honest efforts to try to do this. You know, early on in the tenure, DPA had a different issue when it came to backlog. And we did big technology upgrades and enabling work through electronic document management, virtual call centers. And then it just got to the point, and I realized that the staff, I think, were just pressed. And all of these things kind of coalesced between an expiring emergency health order. So we lost flexibility on how federal programs are administered. We also had our eye on down at the goal line thinking about Medicaid redetermination when the federal emergency expires, that was going to be a big issue. And it was a perfect storm of events that hit. And, you know, as this started being evaluated about, oh, how bad is this going to be? There was the conversations. It was like August and September. Like, okay, what do we need to do this? What are the other resources? And we finally had some successful hiring rounds. But it's a new renewed focus that Commissioner Hedberg and the governor's office are doing on this. And it's not something that it's easy. And I feel bad for all of the Alaskans that have been left in the lurch like this. And I thank all of our advocates and stakeholders that are continuing to support these individuals while this gets resolved.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, good afternoon. my question relates to something that happened with your predecessor, and I want to know how you would handle this, because I don't know how I would. Your predecessor, I think in the spring of 2021, this is my best guess, I don't think it was last year, was proposing on behalf of the governor that we overdraw the ERA by $3 billion one time, and that then, I can't remember what followed from that, except that naturally it helped the out years, and we could sort of balance budgets for years to come on the backs of that overdraw. Now, that's a policy call. It's not one I agree with or agreed with then. But here's where it got odd to me. She had this other hat that was a trustee of the Permanent Fund Corporation. And that corporation says, thou shalt not overdraw. It doesn't say you can't set it at, I could be wrong about this. It doesn't say we insist that it be 5%, but it says make it sustainable and stable. And there have been repeated resolutions where the Permanent Fund trustees said, don't overdraw this fund. When you set it, set it. And I have no idea how she could wear the one hat in the day and then this other hat at night or whatever. And I don't know. I think that must have been a real problem for her, and I want to know how you would handle that.
Through the chair to Representative Josephson, I can appreciate that. I have to say that the legal counsel we have at the Department of Law, as well as the legal counsel over at the Permanent Fund Corp., have done a fantastic job of onboarding anybody who sits in this seat about explaining the importance of fiduciary status. That is one of the highest legal responsibilities there is in law, as you're aware, because you know Supreme Court findings have found that a fiduciary who fails to actually take in and account for risk and use it for his own personal benefit can be held personally liable. And so it really is a very important role. And so we are instructed at any one time that if we are acting in a fiduciary capacity, that is the only hat we are wearing. So as a trustee for the Permanent Fund Corporation, you're sitting there as a fiduciary. And so that is something that I look at when I have those responsibilities as to what is the goal of the management for the best health of the fund and resolutions therein. And then there's on the other side, if there's different conversations, I apologize. I was, as mentioned, I was a little distracted in early 2021 with some of the other items going on. So I don't remember that particular conversation. But it is something you have to we have to weigh into measures, like what are those policy items? I would say that, you know, fully as a trustee, understand that the appropriation of those funds is actually up 100% up to the purview of the legislature when it comes to that. And the trustees sit there to make these resolutions about what is the fund health, using the best available advice from a consultant's and from a risk perspective. And so that's what you do as a fiduciary side. Policy calls on the other front, wearing the different hat as role of commissioner and working for the executive branch, it changes. And that's a very difficult position to be in, and I hope I don't have to get there.
Okay. Follow-up?
Follow-up, Representative Josephson.
I hope that you don't also. And I don't know how to resolve that conundrum. It seems impossible to do to me. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. Through the chair, Commissioner and Commissioner Designee, I want to thank you very much for offering to serve. I know it's a lot on your family, and I know that it shares your sense of hope for the state. And speaking of that, I wondered if you would talk to me a little bit about the credit rating for the state. I know that we made it through and have done this historically as a state through this last cycle of downturn and even in the recent past when there was another one, we managed to do quite nicely. So I wondered if there's anything you could imagine doing in the future to help us earn that very important credit rating that would help fill our coffers even more.
Through the chair, Representative Galvin. It's an excellent question. So the credit rating sits in a unique perspective for the state of Alaska because really what it requires is selling the story of the state. What are the active projects that we do have on? What are the prospects in the future? And what is our current financial health? I'm very much looking forward to doing this in a more robust manner. We've had initial conversations with credit rating agencies this spring. On a couple of them, we were actually able to move one from negative to stable and one from stable to positive. When we pitch what is going on, here's some of the legislation that's going, and here's they even asking these questions, just to be frank, like how's the relationship with the legislature? How's everybody working together? Because that goes into their overall look of what these credit rating agencies are doing. And so we have a very robust plan that we're going to go to as we get later into session, hopefully that a budget has passed one or both bodies and perhaps in a conference committee to where myself and a couple staff members will go to New York to have one-on-ones. And it's multiple credit rating agencies. It's at least three that we'll sit down with and spend very multi-hour long meetings telling them of all of the prospects of what's going on. This is the overall health of the state. And how do we move forward? And these are the things that we are actively working on, either through policy and a current regulatory authority or even new statutory authority gigs. So it's an intriguing process because you really are doing business development for the state. So items like the carbon credit process and the carbon offsets is an intriguing prospect to the credit rating agencies because they like the idea of state-sponsored carbon programs. It's also just another new revenue diversification aspect. One item that has popped up in these credit rating agencies, these meetings, has been the fact that the POMV growing in the fact that it's going to be a greater share this coming year of our state revenues as opposed to commodities is a positive thing because it's a stable 5-year smoothing process to get to that number. And so it's anything that we can do to bring stability helps the overall prospects on the state's ability to borrow money. The state's ability to borrow money, in turn, it doesn't directly influence private companies' ability to borrow money, but it does have an effect on how their banks look at it. Where is Alaska set? Is there a positive outcome going on over time, whether or not they will invest in projects? So I recognize it's a critical aspect. I have brought on fantastic staff to help with this. My deputy commissioner has years of experience doing this for the North Slope Borough, dealing with very large budgets and going in this process to do this. The North Slope Borough being a very revenue-heavy area, but they've got a very expensive landscape that they try to take care of their people. They do bonds and revenue bonds a lot. And so his background in this is very good. The gaps that I have in this role, he absolutely helps fill.
Anyone else? Representative Tomaszewski, followed by Representative Kronk.
Thank you, Co-Chair Johnson. Through the chair, Mr. Crum, thank you for coming in and being available to answer these questions. And I appreciate the subject of economic development being one of your priorities. Can you just list us one priority within economic development that you would like to focus on in the near future?
Through the chair, Representative Tomaszewski, thank you for that. I think we can all agree that we don't have enough people in the state. The out-migration over the last 9 years is not good for anybody. It casts a pall, so to speak. And so we have to find ways to take care of that. That is through a couple of different things, both on economic opportunity, meaning here's the prospects, you can come have good-paying jobs, but also how do you bring people up here? That's actually having housing. That's one of the key priorities. As sitting on the board of the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, as well as with ADA, this is an item that is being addressed by both bodies, as well as across the executive branch between DNR, Commerce, and DEC, because, you know, there's issues around land cleanup from the Fairbanks area, as you're well aware. There's a lot of legacy spills that need items to be addressed. And what can the state do to possibly invest to help clean that up to make it affordable for developers to put together units? And so it's a multi-pronged approach on housing in that we both need inventory and we also need access to capital to purchase. Not necessarily on the cheaper loans, because we've actually had low mortgage rates for a long time. It's actually what's required on the down payment side and or flexibility around that. And so that is a key area that we're looking at concurrently with all of the other items when it looks to projects and local economic development that we could do across the board. We can't just focus on one thing. This is an all hands on deck. We need to look across the board on how do we get a positive outlook, people excited to be here so we can grow our state.
And Representative Kronk.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, Representative Tomaszewski pretty much, I think you answered it. And I just want to thank you. Even before I was serving, you know, listening to you, you always answered tough questions. And I really appreciate that because when you falter answering tough questions, when it gets tough, you might not, you know, might not all be there. But I think we joke around. I was like, it's the sooner you figure out how to plant money trees, the better off the state's going to be. But I just want to, I just appreciate how you answer tough questions and you don't shy away from those. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Kronk. This is through the chair. I always joke that when I took on this role, I was an offensive lineman in college, meaning that on every play, you know, you were going to have to get hit in the face and still had to move forward. And that's part of what the job is you know what's going to come, but can you stand there and take it and make sure you're doing the correct thing? Thank you.
I do have one question before we go to public testimony. I guess the one I would have is as we do progress through the issues with SNAP and so on, that you will be involved. I know that you will be, but just if you would just maybe speak to how you're leaving the department behind, I mean, the hands that you're leaving the department in, and how, as someone that's still in the administration, how you could still have an impact on the department and the problems that they have.
Absolutely. Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, when you look at every organization has its issues, but then you look at if there is leadership turnover, what does happen to the rest of the team? When you look at the Department of Health, my entire executive team is still in place. I was able to bring on and hire Deputy Commissioner of Medicaid because I had a retirement shortly before I left, as well as a new ledge liaison. To them, they still tease me because I hired them, and a week later, I found out I was moving over here. It wasn't a pre-planned thing, and they always joke that we were coming to work with you. But we still have the leadership team in place. Dr. Zink, Director Hedberg, now Commissioner Hedberg, are still there addressing these issues. And so the department is still continuing the momentum that has been developed. A lot of the key things that were worked out throughout COVID was the value of relationships and partnerships. It was working with our tribal health partners, with our communities, and having these discussions that, you know, health department would never normally have, but it turned into an economic development vehicle. And the fact that we had to share information on how do we actually support these industries going forward in a tough time. And so that whole mindset of maintaining those relationships and continuing to do outreach is a very important item, particularly when you talk about a department that's got the single largest budget item being for the Medicaid.
All right. Well, seeing no additional questions from the committee, thank you, Commissioner-Designee Crum. I will be opening public testimony. Is there anyone, and you could go ahead and we'll just invite anyone else that would like to come to the table. If there's anyone here in the room that would like to testify, public testimony is now open. Seeing no one come forward, I am going to close public testimony here in the room and see, is there anyone online that would like to testify? I'm looking, and there's no one online that is here to test that wants to testify. So with no one in the room to testify under public testimony, nor online, with that I will be closing public testimony. Representative Edgman, do you have a motion?
Madam Chair, the House Finance Committee has reviewed the qualifications of the governor's appointee and recommends that the following name be forwarded to the joint session for consideration: Adam Crum, Commissioner Designee for the Department of Revenue. This does not reflect an intention by any member to vote for or against this individual during any further session for the purpose of confirmation. And that is the extent of the motion.
Yes. All right, we have a motion before us, and seeing no objections, we will take a brief at ease to sign the paperwork. Thank you. I guess I should say the motion to move. The motion has passed, and to move the recommendation forward to recommend Commissioner Designee Crum to be considered by the joint session. At ease. It's back on the record. Next, we will receive a budget overview from the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. Presenting will be Commissioner Ryan Anderson, the Director of Administrative Services, and his Deputy Commissioner as well. Commissioner Anderson, would you please come forward, put yourself on the record, introduce any of your staff, and welcome to House Finance. Go ahead and start your presentation.
Hey, thank you, Chair Johnson. For the record, my name is Ryan Anderson. I'm the Commissioner of the Alaska Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. With me today is Mr. Dom Pannone. He's our Administrative Services Director. And in the audience, I also have Deputy Commissioner Catherine Keith, as well as our legislative liaison, Andy Mills. If the chair is okay, we would just go ahead and proceed with the presentation.
Certainly. Let's go ahead and begin.
Thank you. Well, first of all, thank you for this opportunity to speak in front of the House Finance Committee today. We love talking about our DOT budgets. These are what drive us, in particular today. The operating budget, this is the budget that gets the work done when we're plowing roads, we're fixing potholes, we're out there with the Marine Highway System operating the system. It's the budget that, you know, supports all of our administrative staff as we're supporting all these important pieces of maintaining and operating our infrastructure throughout the state. Alaska's mission is keep Alaska, or DOT's mission is keep Alaska moving. And how we like to do that, we recognize that these days it's a changing world. There's a lot, especially in transportation, that is changing. And we want to really focus on being modern, resilient, and adaptable. And as we go forward, I think what you'll see in today's presentation is our efforts to do some of those things from the operating side. But it also is a focus for us on safety, making sure we're taking good care of our infrastructure out there. We are thinking about things like economic vitality. We're thinking of things like sustainability and as well as resiliency these days. That's another really important aspect for us. And recognizing that, you know, we have a multimodal transportation system. We really need to think hard about as we move forward and we operate that system to find those efficiencies to do the best job we can in the future. So with that, I'll go to the next slide. So what you'll see on the DOT organization, we have 14 divisions, and this is really how we keep Alaska moving. You'll see we have the three regions, Northern Region, Central Region, and South Coast Region. And that's primarily where our planning, our design, our construction of all of our infrastructure projects happen, as well as the maintenance and operations, the majority that happens for the highway system, for the rural airport systems there. We also have our kind of our services that we have out there, like the statewide equipment fleet, the facility services, where we're actually providing a service to other agencies, trying to do a good job, you know, making sure that they can accomplish their missions as well. That's important to us. You'll see we have a lot of support services. Program development is where, you know, the funding pieces happen. Statewide design and engineering services, they really oversee our infrastructure and how we're doing, maintaining all of it. And then, of course, the international airports as well. The two international airports fall under the DOT purview. One thing I do like to talk about on this slide is we're really trying to think hard of DOT as the entire organization, as a team, and that all of these different divisions, even though they're their own separate divisions, we work across divisions when the challenges happen so that we can resource things as we need to. And these days we've done more and more of that depending on the challenge. And I think we've had some pretty good successes on that as well. With IIJA and all the additional funds that are coming our way, you know, we're resourcing that where the resources are. When you look at partnerships with contractors, local governments, those types of things, you know, we look at that holistically across our divisions and really try to make the most of that. One other thing to note on this one is each one of these divisions either reports to myself or one of the other two deputy commissioners.
For the record, Dom Pannone, Admin Director for DOT. So on a technical level, the budget can look pretty intimidating for DOT. We're on the higher end of the spectrum when it comes to fund sources. We have 19 different fund sources. And then on the right here on the slide, you'll see we have seven main budgetary blocks, the bold headers. And we refer to these as results delivery units, or RDUs. Underneath those, you'll see we have 52 discrete budgetary components, each with its own personal services, travel, contractual, and commodities lines. We're staying at a high level today. We're going to be walking through the 7 bold results delivery units, those RDUs. We'll be talking about the changes happening in each of those. Go to the next slide.
And for the record, Ryan Anderson, Commissioner of DOT. This slide depicts the services that the department provides. Modernizing Alaska's infrastructure is really our commitment to keeping Alaska's infrastructure modern and in shape to serve Alaskans as we move into the future. You can see a lot of this is primarily focused on project delivery. This is where all the projects are happening. Operating Alaska's transportation infrastructure, you can see all the various functions that the Alaska Department of Transportation and Public Facilities takes on, everything from traffic signal management to avalanche mitigation, surface marking, you know, painting our highways, and then in our important rural areas, safety and security on our airport side. Preserving Alaska's infrastructure is another big service the department provides. Abandoned vehicle removal is something that we've taken on to try to put more energy behind to just help keep our right-of-ways across the state and other areas, airports, get them cleaned up. You can see things like the international airports, of course, the marine highway system. Those are providing transportation services, excuse me. But bridge inspection and preservation is another one that I would like to highlight under preserve. We have operating folks that are out there and doing biannual bridge inspections. Every one of our bridges out there is inspected once every 2 years. There's a lot packed into this and the services we provide, all the way down to, you know, the shared services that we continue to provide with the statewide equipment fleet and the Division of Facility Services.
Question. Representative Tomaszewski.
Thank you, Co-Chair Johnson. Through the chair, Commissioner Anderson, in regards to a project that has been brought to my attention through and a concern from a lot of folks is the Manned Show project. Now I see you have a transportation advisory committee, and I've been reading through that and following it, and I applaud the direction of your outreach and working with the people of the area. But one of the questions that was brought to me just this weekend was, what will be the cost to the state in regards to the Manned Show project? And I don't expect an answer today, but in regards to maintenance, extra maintenance, the study, bridges, that sort of thing, you know, what will be the cost to the state as a whole in regards to this specific project?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Tomaszewski. No, that is a great question. It's a question that, you know, we're tackling internally, as well as through the Transportation Advisory Committee. There's, you know, in relation to today's presentation, you know, the operating costs, those are something we're looking at, that daily maintenance of the highway type of activity, whether it's repairing road damages that could be caused by increased traffic, or, you know, if there's a anticipated increased level of maintenance for winter snow removal, for example. Those are all things that, you know, we're going to be running through the scenarios and identifying and making sure that, you know, the public understands, you know, what these costs are as we go through. The Transportation Advisory Committee is how we anticipate, you know, making everyone aware, because that is it's a public process that we're going through there to make sure we're covering not only the operational costs, but important safety considerations that have been brought up. So that is definitely on our work to-do list.
Thank you.
Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, under operating Alaska's infrastructure, Commissioner, good to see you. Snow and ice management. So Anchorage had 3 snowmageddons. It essentially shut down the city. And that's a little overstated, but not completely. I know that's part of your M&O section, I guess. If that section had had more money, in other words, if we appropriated more in anticipation of a winter like this one, could it have been spent to aid my community? Would you have had the staff? Would you have had the machinery, et cetera?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Josephson. a great question. Additional resources is what it takes to be more responsive, to increase your level of service is how we look at it. We have a priority system at DOT when we go out and plow the roads, priority 1, 2, 3, and 4, and it's really based on how quickly we think we can clear a roadway after a storm event. And so the more plow trucks we have, for example, the quicker we could get to priority 2 roads versus priority 1 roads, the quicker we can get through that priority system. And that's really how we would look at it, with additional funds and resources, but also having the people. We have done more and more when we run into vacancy problems with contracting out, because we recognize there's a resource there as well that's available. Sometimes it's not. We've also learned that sometimes those resources are stretched pretty thin too. I guess the answer is, if additional funding, additional resources were available, we could work and work through our priority list quicker.
Thank you.
Question?
Representative Plum.
Thank you, Chair. To the Chair, thank you, Commissioner. I wanted to go back a slide, and I'm sorry I'm new here, but one of the fund codes is called the Public Building Fund. Can you enlighten me on what that is?
Yeah, through the Chair, Representative Coulomb. The Public Building Fund is a sinking fund for a specific set of state office buildings. And this fund came to the department just last year and previously was managed by the Department of Administration. What we do is we collect fees for the maintenance and operations of these state buildings, and also collect fees to depreciate building improvements that we've made. So we collect those so that we can continue to reinvest those into maintenance needs or deferred maintenance needs of the state office buildings.
Okay, can I have a follow-up?
Follow-up.
So are those, can you give me a roundabout balance of the fund, and can the fund be used for any other use other than the public buildings?
Through the Chair, Representative Coulomb, I don't have the balance with me today, but we can provide it back to the committee. The funds can be appropriated however the legislature sees fit.
Okay, thank you.
For the record, again, Dom Pannone. So one challenge for our operating budget over the last few years is cost increases for our commodities. And you'll see on the left side of this slide, the amount budgeted in our commodities at the department level is significant, especially when you compare it to the other departments. We buy more commodities than the next two highest departments combined. And in trying to communicate and quantify what we're seeing with commodities increases, we wanted to share a cost index our federal partner publishes called the National Highway Construction Cost Index. This is a 20-year-old index which shows at a national level that highway construction costs rose 16.8% during the pandemic. The significance here is there's a lot of overlap between the components of this index on the right and the components of our operating budget, specifically our maintenance and operations. So you have equipment and labor, lighting, utilities, signals and signs, guardrails, and raw materials. In our maintenance and operation budget, we have $23 million in commodities. So there's a significant impact there. And we'll be talking about those requests on subsequent slides.
So I had a phone call this 10 days ago from someone that was that I've known almost my whole life, that is a contractor, does a lot of heavy construction, really, road construction, so on. And he was trying to bid projects or put his bids together. And he said there are a number of places out there they're not even quoting prices yet because things are so unstable as far as and what's going to be available. I guess probably asphalt and so on. I don't know for sure materials, but have you found anything to that effect? And are you having how are you going to account for that? I mean, later on in the summer as you get into the season.
Yeah, Chair Johnson, it's a great question. It is getting tougher for contractors. We've heard from contractors that it is. we constantly bid out projects, and we typically see it as a result of our bid prices. When the uncertainty goes up, the bid prices go up. And that's how a lot of contractors typically deal with it. Although we have been talking more about some of these alternative procurement methods where, you can bring on contractors early in the design and you can work together when you're figuring out timelines for your projects and how these supply chain challenges may affect a project. So it's more of a teamed approach. Those are other ways we've been tackling it. We are in some discussions with AGC about how things are going, and should the department work through our contracting processes and whatnot and any differently, just to make sure we're getting the best value for our funding, and that's a continuing discussion right now for us on that one. I would also like to just add on this slide with commodities, the climate, the things that are happening with weather, particularly up north, it's not just about prices for us, it's about the use. And you'll see, when we get into a winter like we had, there was a pretty tough winter last year in Fairbanks. I was talking to some foremen from Barrow just the other week, and they were talking about the rain in Barrow. Those all things drive us to use chemical and to really, we're having to do more with those types of things to really make sure we can do our job and keep those surfaces in safe conditions. So that is part of something that drives our commodities when we have these increasing, warm weather events or precipitation type events in the wintertime. Those do affect us. But we also are trying to do some things to bring costs down. We're working through a sustainable transportation program where we want to, take all of these old sodium streetlights across the state and convert them to LEDs. That's something that saves us money. And we're also looking at, these ideas like electric vehicles out there. And are there places where, like maybe in Juneau or places with hydro, where those would make sense and really, reduce our costs as well. So we're trying to balance that. As we see these prices go up, where can we find the savings? The next slide represents one of our big challenges with our operating budgets these years, and it's really about people. You can see this is a annual vacancy rate that was sampled monthly for calendar year 2022. And so I just want to make sure that that's understood. This is from 2022. Things change from us on these vacancy sheets from year to year and from month to month, to be totally honest right now. But you can see in what we're learning, and we are paying attention to our vacancy rates very closely. And this is primarily for equipment operators, highways and aviation LTC positions, which also would include mechanics and the trades. There's a pretty big difference variable depending on location. And so one thing we've been, working hard at is trying to address these, and it's really on a case-by-case basis. Is some areas are doing okay. We don't see the vacancy rates happening. But in other areas, you'll see 30, 40%. We've seen over 50% in some areas. And those are the ones where we have to take action to keep our infrastructure and operations going.
Representative Stapp.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the Chair to Director Anderson. So just out of curiosity, I see Dillingham in the central region, and I see King Salmon in the south coast region. What is the reasoning behind having those two places in different regions on the slide?
Yeah, through the Chair, Representative Stapp. We defined boundaries, regional boundaries. That was something might have been 10 years ago now when there was a boundary change that was proposed and implemented that did separate out, central region into a smaller region, and then it took South Coast and the folks headquartered down in Juneau, and then it spread it out down in southwest Alaska to the Aleutians. And that was just a decision made at the time. Again, I'm a big advocate that we're working across those divisions on those things that make sense, because just because you have a line on a piece of paper shouldn't mean that, we aren't doing things that make sense. So I guess that would
Follow up, Madam Chair?
Yes, follow up.
Yeah, so I guess, sorry, there's a geographic hole on your map, I guess, because Dillingham is between Kingsham and some of the other communities. So I guess I don't understand, but I'll leave it at that. Thanks.
Madam, through the chair, if I can respond, the northern region does extend all the way the length of the state, and that's due to the pipeline, all roads that run parallel to the pipeline. So it can be misleading to see some of these locations categorized as the northern region.
All right, Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. I just need a clarification on what aviation LTC positions is.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Hannon. The Labor Trades and Crafts Union is the LTC, and so the highways and they work both on the highway side and our aviation side.
One follow-up. Do we have aviation positions that are not labor, trades, and crafts positions, or are they all?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon. Well, we do have aviation positions that would be in the supervisory or general government units. We also have in rural Alaska contractors that work on the airports. That's primarily it's contractors that maintain those rural airports.
Okay, thank you.
Oh, Representative Cronk.
Sorry. Thank you, Madam Chair. Quick question. I'm looking at Northern Region, and I'm just looking. Half of these are in my district. And so if I'm looking at, let's just say Birch Lake, so what it's saying, there are three positions. That's three total positions, right? And there's zero vacancy. So Northway, there's five positions, and there's a vacancy. That's the total positions, right, that are available. Is that correct?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Cronk, that's correct.
Okay. I guess looking at this, and I know you've done some two-on-two scheduling up on the Hall Road and stuff. How is that working out?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Cronk. Yeah, the 2x2 schedule on the Hall Road, and we'll have that here later in the presentation. Okay. That has been a success for us in terms of keeping the vacancy rates down.
Follow up. Through the chair, what would you determine to be the biggest factor in these vacancy rates? Would it be losing operators to private industry just because they're able to pay more?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Cronk. It's tough to conjecture what would be, but I can tell you what we've seen. We have seen people leave for higher paying jobs. That is true. I think we've seen people to leave for family reasons. Maybe there's other things going on in their lives and they leave the state. That's been another. Some areas, I think, depending on what's going on in the community, you know, we do compete with summer work, and that's a big one for us when the big projects come in, and that's been a lot of discussion when the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act picks up and there's a lot of infrastructure jobs out there. That's more competition for us.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, Commissioner, just to make doubly sure here, you have the resources right now to hire 53 more people in, I'm going to guess it's the Fairbanks North Star Borough. 53 more people right now are needed and funded, but they're not there showing up at work. Is that what that says?
For the record, Don Pannone, through the chair, Representative Josephson, the column there shows the amount of positions in the budget total. And then the column was the vacancy rate for calendar year 2022.
Thank you.
Representative Colomb.
Thank you, Chair. Through the chair. So not to belabor this, but I'm trying to get to some root causes of what happened in Anchorage. So it sounds like it was maybe more money. Doesn't look like the vacancy rate's super high in Anchorage. So in your opinion, what happened in Anchorage other than it was a lot of snow, and I understand that. It looks like we're getting our snow lots are filling. But was it, my impression was a lack of operators. I thought the vacancy rate was higher for you. It was really high for the municipality for sure. But I'm in South Anchorage, and so we have all the hillside roads, Huffman, O'Malley, and Abbott. So in retrospect, was there something that we could have done or you could have done that would have avoided what happened?
Through the chair, Representative Colomb, that, you know, whenever we have one of these big snow events, and that one that happened in Anchorage was one of the bigger snow events, you know, we're staffed for a pretty good operation, meaning efficiency. So we don't staff for the giants, you know, the big storm events. We're staffed in the mid-range. And then when the snow events come, you know, we work overtime and we work to get those things done. So I think that's probably that most likely what you saw in Anchorage, and is, you know, we were out there, our guys were full on working overtime. We had all the equipment out there, had to keep the main lines running. Sometimes it's difficult too, because where the DOT lines end and the municipality begins, and there's different priorities sometimes that are being worked. And so I think that can cause some confusion out there as well. But we are working with municipality, and we're trying to make sure we're going to do better on those types of things too.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. For the record, Ryan Anderson. And this one is just a further one of the vacancy rates and the tracking. And the one thing we did want to let everybody know is, you know, we get weekly vacancy rate reports, and we are monitoring trends and trying to recognize and be ahead of when we start seeing we're losing people in a certain area and we see that trend line. And this is where we start pulling out the tools where, you know, maybe a 2x2 schedule or a week on, week off schedule. There are places where we have to start in rural areas, maybe flying people in because we just can't find the people locally. There's also the mission critical incentive pay, where we've tried to provide a pay incentive in certain areas when we recognize that we may not be able to, you know, keep an airport open for the duration that people expect. And so those types of things are all tools we look at.
So one of the questions that's came up is, and I think DOT, as much as any department, people can have some concern that there's a lot of money that goes to admin or whatever, and maybe doesn't actually impact the services that are directly to, you know, to their constituents or to the people of Alaska. So I guess, how do you see if someone actually wanted to put money in the budget and said, well, this is to make sure that our road services are better or so on? How would you see that the best way to go about doing that?
Chair Johnson, well, you know, I always look at things through services provided. And if there's a service or, you know, one of the things we had intent language last session about reviewing our road priorities and making sure they were aligned with, you know, what the public expectation is to make sure we're doing a better job there. I think there are those types of ways that, you know, legislature could communicate to us where they would, you know, want a DOT to focus funds. That may be an option. I might pass it off to Mr. Pannone to see if he has any ideas there as well.
For the record, Don Pannone, Madam Chair Johnson, it's an excellent question. The highways and aviation components are the components where our operators and services are provided. Most of the indirect support is budgeted for in different components. So certainly placing more funding in the components would send that message that the funds were for services.
All right. Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. Through the chair, I wondered if one of the tools you've employed is training the younger folks, and if so, have you found what I heard earlier today was one group is training bus drivers, for example, and what is happening is they're training them for free, and then they're leaving so that they can make 50% more in another employer. And I'm not sure if you're experiencing that or if you've even tried that, and how how it's gone on that end.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Galvin, we are tackling the training piece, right now. We have a CDL, a commercial driver's license scholarship program that we've instituted, and it turns out that to get a commercial driver's license can be $15,000 to $20,000. And so we through some of our Fed aid programs, they allow us to expend money on those types of trainings. And so we're doing that. And we've had some success. So I think right now there was four or five individuals that we had programmed and they're going through the training. We've done some things in rural Alaska where we've actually been able to hire a greater trainer from Iowa. And we would send that individual out to places where we could get enough graders together, places like Nome, Tok, Bethel, and last summer we hit quite a few of them just to give people basic training that, you don't need that certification, but you need to understand how to operate a piece of equipment. So we've done some things like that. And on the Marine Highway side, we're really focused on establishing a training program right now for mariners and to make sure we can get the entry-level folks in there to help us out with that challenge as well.
Follow up, but I'm going to say, I'm going to take the last question on this page because we've got a rest of the presentation to get through.
That's fantastic, and I wondered if you're doing anything in particular to retain them once you've trained them, if there's any incentive program or how that's working.
Through the chair, Representative Galvin. Yeah, those get tougher at times. We can write in a commitment, if you accept an offer or accept a benefit for training. You can do that through like a letter of agreement or something with the unions. But it's typically a little bit, it's tougher on that front to come up with that commitment piece.
All right. We can go ahead and move on.
For the record, Dom Pannone. So this is a graph we include every year for comparison showing last year's actual expenditures for 2022. And then in the middle there, the current fiscal year 2023. And then the requested budget for fiscal year 2024. And the final column on the right is just to show the magnitude of the change between the current year and the requested budget. Each year here is broken out by fund group. We have other Fed, DGF, and UGF. The other fund group, it's a very large group here in orange, is largely duplicate funds that come from somewhere else either in our own budget or another department's budget or from the private sector. $183 million of this other group comes from our capital budget as capital improvement project receipts. $109 million of this other group is international airport revenue funds, which are funded directly through rates and fees collected from the airline industry. $128 million of the other group is for shared services that we bill other departments and ourselves and collect for our shared services like facility services or the statewide equipment fleet. So even though the other funds are mostly duplicate, they do provide an accurate representation of the magnitude of services we're providing and the amount of funds that are flowing through our operational budget. The next layer of funds there, the federal funds in gray, that's largely, there's two drivers for that, federal funding in the Marine Highway System and federal funding related to COVID relief funds that the department received directly. We have used those in the last few years to offset UGF as well as increase some services. The last two fund groups, the blue and gold, are our DGF and UGF. And the DGF is motor fuel tax receipts, marine highway revenues, program receipts, and then vehicle rental tax. So overall, the fiscal year 2024 request is increasing our operations by approximately $35 million. And those increases are driven largely by two things, increases in the marine highway system and the international airport system. There's also roughly $8 million for salary adjustments, which are adjustments negotiated by labor relations and Department of Administration. There's also some small maintenance and operations, some smaller maintenance and operations increases for our highways and aviation.
All right. We have a question from Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Chair, through the chair. Commissioner or Mr. Pannone, this particular slide reflects DOT overall, not just aviation and transportation, correct? Or aviation and highways, correct?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, this is the entire department for the operational.
Okay. And so with that understanding, it would seem like with the awards that are being put forward through IGA that the gray bar for FY24 would be significantly bigger than, let's say, the gray in FY2022. Why is that not the case?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, the gray in fiscal year 2022, the federal funds, was largely the COVID relief funds used to forward fund the ferry system, as well as approximately $17 million of COVID relief funds we used to offset UGF. In 2023 and 2024, the federal funds are the rural ferry grant program that was new from the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, as well as some continued UGF displacement. The increases that you referred to are going to be seen largely on the capital budget, on the capital side. And so you wouldn't necessarily see them here in this budget today.
Oh. Okay, thank you. That helps. Thanks.
Representative Hammond.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Pinone, I'm going to follow up with Rep. Ortiz's and go to the DGF in FY24. Specifically trying to make, so we've got this huge infusion in our capital budget of federal monies that we need to match, and we're going to use some of our, what we've referred to as fare box recovery, but some of the federal matching language, I guess we're calling it tolls. And so I thought we would see a decrease in FY24 in that DGF because some of that toll revenue is going to need to go into our capital budget to match the federal monies. But it looks like here we're going to see a substantial increase in our DGF, and perhaps we're expecting it from other things, and it's the toll money that we're going to send to capital is already accounted for there. So there's a big increase in DGF, and you said one of those big components is marine highways, fare box recovery. So what else is in there?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon. So the operational increase for the ferry systems budget is approximately $13 million. That is an increase to the ferry systems to keep the level of service we budgeted for. And we're using the ferry system revenues to fund that increase. The toll credits that were referenced are something that we could present on in a capital budget, but those are credits for dollars we've spent in the past on capital improvements, and we're using those credits in the capital budget to match the capital grants. But in this operating budget, the UGF and the DGF are what's matching the operating grant of $45 million.
Thank you.
So I'm think there's a lot of detail in your upcoming slides. It actually looked like they might answer some of the questions that we've had, and or certainly the Marine Highway, I think, is the last sheet here, so save up your Marine Highway questions, and we can get after those. But if we could, we'll go ahead and hold the questions, at least get through a few slides here before we ask more questions. So go ahead. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Moving to slide 9. So this is the first RDU we're looking at. This is the admin and support RDU. The first bullet on this slide is for the Highway Safety Office. This is a federally required program under Title 23. All we're doing here with this is moving the office out of a division that it exists in now, that statewide program development, and we're moving it into its own new component to reflect the reporting structure and the significance. This office, its focus is to reduce traffic accidents on our roadways, reducing deaths, reducing injuries, and reducing property damage. And so this component is focused on largely public safety. The second bullet here is the Statewide Safety and Emergency Management Program. This is different in that it's also a new component, but it's focused more internally on department safety, on safety training and disaster response. So safety training for our employees. A large part of this this component relates directly to safety training, which is a program we implemented in 2015, a department-wide safety training program that reduced our statewide, the department's workers' comp claims from 6 million to half, to 3 million. And since 2015, by putting an emphasis on safety training, we've continued to see that trend down. In 2022, the claims were less than half a million. This component also coordinates with the Division of Military and Veterans Affairs for state disaster response on providing resources or receiving resources, and also implements incident command system training, which is the way that the department organizes responses to state disasters and emergencies.
Ryan Anderson for the record. This slide represents our design, engineering, and construction of folks, and this is really where, when we talk about the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, the $1.6 billion capital budget last year, $1.4 billion proposed in 2024, this is where that work's happening, where that project delivery piece that's not only in-house staff, but a lot of contract work just to deliver that program. As you can see, we have the increases for health insurance salaries. We also have been doing some position management to make sure we're running in the most efficient way possible, and there was a transfer of authority within Northern Region for a public information officer that helped make some other moves whole. And then also we've been working to combine components. We started in Northern Region with Northern Design and Engineering and Construction, and what we're doing there is taking two components that are very closely related, combining them, so we just get the efficiencies, administrative efficiency over time on making those work.
For the record, Dom Pannone on slide 11. Our Highways, Aviation, and Facilities RDU, the first budgetary action we're taking this year is we're reversing the one-time fund swaps that we did with COVID relief funds last year. These are all accomplished with one-time items, so they have to be reversed every year. And then moving to bullet two, we still have COVID relief funds that we can use in our rural aviation system for our rural airports. So we are swapping $9.8 million of UGF to take advantage of these federal funds that came directly to the department. We're also requesting $1.3 million in commodities increases. This is for the highways maintenance services we provide to give them a boost. As we mentioned earlier, we're seeing significant increases for our commodities. The next bullet there is the King Salmon Airport Federal Authority. So we share maintenance of this airport with the U.S. Air Force. And in the past, the Air Force has paid for a number of their expenses directly from their own funds. And in renegotiating this agreement, it was agreed to that the state would pay for it upfront and then get reimbursed. So this is federal authority for us to be able to spend the money we receive as part of that agreement. Second from the bottom, maintained increment for ice roads. This increment was added last year by the legislature for, I believe, three different sets of ice roads. And we are moving that to the base of the budget. The last bullet there on the left is the Sitka Airport Fund Swap. So recently, the International Airport System renegotiated a 10-year agreement with the signatory airlines that pay for that fund. And in that agreement, it was determined that Sitka would no longer be designated as an emergency diversion airport. So they're no longer eligible to receive and use international airport revenue funds. So we're swapping the funding back to UGF.
Ryan Anderson for the record. Also, you'll see wayside maintenance improvements. We are looking at improving our waysides in terms of, you know, how often they're cleaned, you know, the outhouses, you know, how often they're getting cleaned, that we're doing general maintenance on in those areas, you know, just to keep upkeep of our maintenance facilities, because over time we recognize that they have been gone downhill a little bit. So we're working through that, and this represents an ability to have increased frequency of maintaining some of those waysides, as well as some much needed improvements like brush clearing and some things like that, just to make them back to where they used to be. You'll also see the increment for the Dalton 2 week on, 2 week off schedule, which we discussed earlier. And I believe also the Chitina, Birch Lake, Silvertip maintenance camps as well on this. Those are continue our focus to make sure that, you know, we're moving forward, keeping those maintenance camps open, recognizing the important role those camps play for Alaskans out there, and keeping that good level of service for maintenance. This slide on facility services, of course, this is one of our shared services. You'll see that facility services and leases was reduced from 6 to 2 components. Again, going for efficiencies there. And then we have the increases for health insurance salary increases. And we have been taking a hard look at facilities, really working through administratively, can we do things more efficiently there and provide a better service to other agencies? We've done some things where we've delegated more construction authority to agencies so they can now contract out more of their own work, as well as providing training on procurement so that when they do that, they're trained for that and we're doing that right. So we're working through facilities right now to make sure that, you know, we're going to do the best job possible delivering that service to other agencies as well as DOT facilities.
For the record, Don Pannone on slide 13. It's our statewide equipment fleet, our other shared service for the executive branch. This is funded by the Highway Equipment Working Capital Fund, which is a duplicate fund. So we bill out all of our operational costs to ourselves, to our M&O budgets, and also to other departments. So DOT's our own biggest customer here. We pay for 80% of these costs. Public safety and the state troopers is our second largest customer. They carry about 8% of these costs. Department of Natural Resources and Fish and Game combined make up 5%, and then they get smaller from there, the rest of our customer departments. The only increase here is for a non-permanent mechanic. Northern Region wanted to see an increased level of service, so they've requested that the SEF hire an extra mechanic for them.
We just have a couple more pages. If you would just write down your question, and we'll get to them on the last page.
All right. Continuing on to slide 14. Our international airport system. This is, again, funded out. The International Airport Revenue Fund is spelled out in statute. It's a self-supporting fund through their rates and fees. The international airport system is seeing traffic up 30% since 2019. So they're having we're seeing some growth there, and they're requesting commensurate budget authority to accommodate that growth and meet the demands of the airport industry. They're requesting funding for 25 new positions using $2.7 million of their fund. They have a request for business operations and administrative expenses of approximately $500,000. They have some equipment there that's decades old and some newer technology equipment that needs to be replaced. One thing they've done is contracted snow removal outside of the tarmac. That's for the parking lots and other areas where they don't need to have specialized operators who are certified to work on runways. That's a $450,000 increase. They've also requested a mission critical incentive pay for emergency services dispatch, maintenance specialists, and equipment operators. And the last is they are also seeing commodities and energy cost increases as well for an increase of $3.9 million.
Ryan Anderson, for the record, the one thing I would just highlight on this slide is we did have a vacancy challenge at Anchorage International Airport last summer and last fall. and that's where you'll see the mission's critical incentive pay. And that we were able to make progress on that, and that has been very beneficial. You know, when we had the big snowfalls in Anchorage this winter, we have had the staff there to address those. And granted, we have a lot of new staff there now, but that was a success story in terms of mission critical incentive pay. And one thing just also to note is we do treat, you know, Fairbanks and Anchorage as a system. And some of these new positions that you see are so that Fairbanks is able to support Anchorage when we do recognize that, you know, there's these vacancy problems that we got to make sure that there's always an alternate for Anchorage when Anchorage, whether the weather goes down or whatnot. And so some of this ties to that as well.
So I think, is this the end of this slide? Are you at the end of this slide? I think you are. Okay, so let's go ahead and take any questions up to but not including the Marine Highway System. If you have anything, Representative Hannon.
Thank you, through Chair Johnson. I want to just go back to the statewide equipment fleet, the additional mechanic, but you're hiring it as a non-perm, and I'm curious why it's not just a permanent position. And, I mean, if we can get a mechanic and secure them, my sense is we don't want to just train them up. We want to keep them. So why is it being hired as a non-perm?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, I believe in this case it was a seasonal worker they were looking for specific. I think it was summer season work, and that's why a non-perm was selected. We have a lot of vacancies for mechanics. If we could fill them right now, we would. I believe in this specific case, it was a specific seasonal type work they were looking for.
One follow-up?
Follow-up.
Can't we still hire them as seasonal permanents? Isn't there something, you know, that's, it's not just a one-shot deal, it's every year, these 5 months? Or are all of our seasonal positions now non-perms?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, certainly we could do that. One thing that we're, again, seeing vacancies at different locations, often what we can do is, instead of expanding our budget permanently by adding new permanent positions, we'll add a non-permanent. That person will come on board and often be and often lateral to a permanent position once we can find them. And it's a way of not increasing the amount of positions unnecessarily.
Okay. Thank you.
So I wanted to ask a question on the airport here. Did you check you said the increase from 2019? I guess it just seems like that would have been a low increase in activity since 2019 is what you were talking about. Forget which one it was you were talking about. But of course, it's up now. I don't know about 2019, but I mean, are you going back to pre-COVID amounts? Or are you comparing with traffic during the COVID years to get the increase request? I mean, if you would, just comment on that.
Yeah, Chair Johnson, I believe what you're – and we could certainly get you that information for the comparison. I believe what you're seeing here is just what our management and our staff feels is needed to keep that system viable, you know, and operational. That's, you know, with the additional positions and the additional funding requests, these are really things that we're just seeing in real time of the needs that are out there. So, we could get you the comparison information, though, for sure.
Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. Through the chair, I'm just curious about the mission critical incentive pay. I'm hoping you can give me a little more context. How many people did you need to bring on, or was this in addition to their pay, or is this their pay? And just a little more context around the $3.7
million. Through the chair, Representative Galvin. So mission critical incentive pay is something that we offer as an incentive for people, you know, whether they're already working in an equipment operator position or we're advertising for the position and trying to attract people. For Anchorage International in particular, it started out as a 20% incentive payment that we were offering. And we only do this where we recognize our mission is being threatened. That's why we call it mission critical, where we feel like we're not going to be able to maintain a service because the vacancy rates are getting so high. And so in that case, we tried the mission critical incentive pay at 20%. We didn't see any increase in hiring, and our vacancy rate stayed flat, and that was through the summer. And so we took the step of increasing it to 30% as an increase to a wage, and that did attract people, and we started seeing the increase, and the vacancy rates got lower, and that was the incentive. That now the mission critical incentive pay, it's not just a DOT decision. These things go through labor relations. It's a LOA with the union, a letter of agreement with the union. And then of course we have to find the budget for it. It's not something that is budgeted at this time. So there's a fair amount of steps to it as we go through those processes.
Representative Kronk.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair. So when we're looking at equipment, what is the price for a grader, plow truck, and do you order like in bulk? I mean, like, do you? How does that work?
Costco.
through the chair, Representative Kronk. You know, I'm not going to give you a price right now because that changes on us a lot these days, and well as the time frames to get equipment right now. I'm hearing some things are 2 years out, and maybe that's not even accurate anymore. But we do, you know, we look at it. We're budgeted for a certain amount of equipment, and so we look at it. And we do try to do contracting that is most efficient. We feel like we get the best price, but we could certainly get you the latest on what the costs are these days and provide that to the committee. That's no problem.
Thank you. Follow up.
And
totally, I'm changing directions here. So when we look at and I'm just going to point out the road from Tok to Fairbanks, Gersel River Bridge, Johnson River Bridge, are they like two of the last trestle style bridges, probably the oldest bridges that haven't been replaced in Alaska?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Kronk. I you know, there's a lot of old bridges in Alaska, so I'm not going to say they're the oldest, but they're definitely World War II era. And those are the bridges that are up for replacement. Those are ones, you know, we monitor structural integrity of these things and, you know, the biannual reviews of all these bridges. Those bridges are safe, but over time you have to keep ahead of these things to make sure it stays that way. And so those are two, yeah, we're looking at replacing.
Follow up.
And then I can identify the Robertson River Bridge. Now is, it's really interesting how narrow that bridge was actually built. So is that in the replacement for that bridge? And is it because it's so, it really is narrow just for two cars to go by? Just question.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Kronk. Yeah, that bridge is, we are looking at for a replacement for that bridge. And yeah, it is very narrow. It's not a bridge that we would build today. And this is part of modernizing our infrastructure. That bridge also has deck problems that need to be taken care of as well. And so, yeah, we're looking at that one pretty hard right now. So, yeah.
Thank you.
Representative Josephson.
A follow-up through the chair on the previous question. Commissioner, were the Gersel and Johnson and Robertson bridges selected because of the Mancho project or notwithstanding the Mancho or Tetlin project?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Josephson. Yeah, those projects have been on our list. I mean, we have a pretty extensive list of bridges that, you know, we either have major work to do or replacement. And those projects were on those lists. We have been looking at activity, economic potential for economic development out in the area, and we're reprioritizing some things. So yeah, we're moving some things around.
I think we're ready for the Marine Highway System.
For the record, Dom Pannone. So the budget here for the Marine Highway System, they're on a calendar year system. So this is the budget proposed for 10 months from now. And it's based largely off of our current calendar year 2023 budget to provide the levels of service we anticipated back in early winter last year, late fall, early winter, when we were assembling this budget. The significant increase here is $13.5 million. We're funding that with the farebox receipts. It's roughly $10 million related to collective bargaining increases that we negotiated with the three unions that run the system, approximately $2.7 million in projected increases in fuel costs, and then increases in travel expenses related to needing to move folks around and pay for that travel to get them to be in the right spot to run the system. The breakout here is based largely the federal and UGF breakout is based on what the legislature appropriated last year. We have $83 million slated for the Rural Ferry Grant Program that was created in the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act. In the current year, 23, we only received $45 million for the operating grant. That's what we have now for the current year. We did base the federal amount on what was set by the legislature and then have included backfill language. If we're not able to be successful in working with the FTA, the Federal Transit Administration, and our congressional delegation on getting all $83 million, we would have access to be able to use our own fare box receipts to make our budget whole.
And for the record, Ryan Anderson, one thing on this slide that we just want to be real transparent about is the challenges with crewing right now. They do affect how we're spending money just because we're not able to run all the ships. And that will be something as we move forward here with our 2023 summer schedule, which, you know, we're anticipating that will get out here. Right now we're shooting for Friday you're going to see that crewing challenge. And we've been spending a little extra time to really make sure that we're going through all of our options with the vessels that are available, with the crews that are available, to make sure we're really providing the best service to Alaskans that we can. And so we're working through those things. I know it's been a frustration for a lot of people on the timing of the summer schedule, and I've received a fair amount of correspondence about it. But we want to make sure we make the best decision here, and so we've been working through that. And, yeah.
Representative Ortiz, then Representative Hanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair, through the Chair, and thank you, Commissioner Anderson, for those comments that you just made, because my question relates to that specific issue. It's my understanding that, your first bullet here says it, budgeted for consistent levels to communities throughout the year, which I think was the idea that 9 ships would be in the water and providing that more consistent level of service. That has not been there recently. But in reality, the plan is to only run 6 ships. Is that correct? We budgeted for 9, but we're only going to run 6. Is that correct?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Ortiz. Yeah, we're budgeted for 9. When we can run 6, that's what we've been doing. And that's what we're shooting for.
You're shooting for 6. The best scenario would be 6. Follow up. Best scenario would be 6.
I'm at this time with our current crewing levels. That's correct.
So what happens then? If we budget for 9 and we're only running 6, that seems like we would have a surplus in the budget. What happens to that money when that takes place? Can it be just simply moved forward, or what happens with that money?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, I'll let Mr. Pinon answer here in a minute, but I did want to say that, you know, we are making efforts as well to provide service through different means other than the ships, and that's through supplemental services and those types of things, just to provide that basic service to communities. So that does cost additional funds, just for that clarification.
For the record, Don Pinon, through the chair, Representative Ortiz. A couple clarifying points. This budget here is for 10 months from now, and we're certainly hopeful that our situation improves. We're making significant efforts to improve the situation. In fiscal year 2021, maybe it was fiscal year 2022, we were budgeted for approximately $108 million. It might have been 21, but because of COVID pandemic restrictions, we simply just did not use our entire budget, and it resulted in our actual expenses being about $96 million. And so a large portion of our budget authority was just simply lapsed. And in this case, we could end up lapsing UGF or lapsing our DGF, our Farebox funds, in which case those are not sweepable and would remain in the system revenue fund for future appropriations if we didn't expend it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Now, getting back to the fundamental issue of why we're not able to provide the level of service that we budgeted for, you spoke, and you have spoken in previous times about the staffing problems that we're having, yet we don't have any vacancy rate as a part of this presentation. Is there a reason for that? In other words, why do we see vacancy rates for airports and highways, but not for the Marine Highway System?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, excellent question. We do have our Deputy Commissioner, also Catherine Keith, available here. Part of that is because when we're calculating vacancy rates, the Marine Highway System manages their personnel in a different system than the rest of the entire state as far as staffing. There's requirements to be fit to sail and fit to be on a in service on the boat. They also have requirements above what they need to simply sail. They need to identify a significant amount it's approximately 20% for when people are unavailable relief positions. So it's not as nuanced as simply having a vacancy rate and meeting that. And I suppose we could provide more information or ask the Deputy Commissioner to come up and speak to that if the committee desired.
And through the chair, Representative Ortiz, we do know how many positions we need to run the ships, and we can provide that information to the committee. It's skilled positions are where we're short right now. And that's really what's driving the decisions that we're making at this point. But those can be available. The statement about reliefs is important at this point. All last summer, we were running the ships with minimal reliefs, and it puts a lot of stress on the crews for sure.
Are you all finished up there, Representative Ortiz?
I could go on, but let's go ahead and move on.
Okay. Well, this is our last slide, and then I just want to make sure if you had any more questions before we finish this up, because I'll probably, Representative Hannon will probably have the last word here.
Okay.
Maybe Rep. Kronk, but go ahead.
No, not right now, thanks.
All right, I wanted to make sure to give you the opportunity. Representative Hannon, then we also have a question from Representative Kronk.
Thank you. Chair Johnson, I'll leave my ferry on the Yukon for Representative Kronk to ask. I'm going to turn specifically to the DGF line on this slide between 23 management plan, where we had zero reporting and Farebox recovery, and $13 million in the 24 amended. And I guess I'm curious whether we really in FY23, what we did with all of our Farebox. We used none of it for operations in 23, and then in 24, showing 13.5, is that predicted on a schedule with six in the summer, six ships, or how much of our total Farebox recovery is that $13 million?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, excellent question. So in 2023, the legislature removed any Farebox receipts from the budget so that we weren't expending them but were collecting them. They were appropriated on the capital side for our annual vessel overhaul for approximately $22 million. And so that is where the receipts were expended. Currently in the revenue fund, we have approximately $20 million in there. We have the rest of the year to go, which is going to continue to build revenues. For fiscal year 2024, we wanted to fund the increase with system revenues. We can provide back to the committee projections in what we think we might get for calendar year 2024 and provide that back to the committee.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Cronk.
Thank you, through the chair. And I'm going to apologize. I'm not on the transportation committee, but I remember when I was, there are two of the newest ferries that were still not being used. Did we get the money to make them usable for the ferry system?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Cronk. Yeah, I believe what you're referring to are the Alaska-class ferries, the Tasman and the Hubbard. Yeah, the Hubbard is just finishing up its capital project where it added crew quarters so it can travel longer. I believe the limitation was 12 hours without crew quarters, and maybe it's 11. But this lengthens that so the ship can go to more ports with a longer time duration. Yeah, we anticipate that ship will be running May 1, and it'll be out serving Alaskans, so we're pretty excited about that. The Tasleena has been in operation off and on as we've needed it. Typically, when we do overhauls for like the LeConte, the Tasleena comes in and takes the LeConte's place to serve Alaskans as well. So we have been using that one, although if we were fully crewed, we would be running those ships full time.
Thank you. Man, we have one.
All right, one last question, Representative Ortiz.
So, and you just mentioned again the crewing issue with the two new ships. It's a good question that was just offered. So we're not fully utilizing them, even though at least one of them is ready to go because of crewing issues. Is that correct?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Ortiz, yes, that's correct.
Okay, and then how does scheduling work in relationship to the ongoing struggles that we have with crewing our vessels here recently? Oh, actually, it's been a while, but how does scheduling work? Because ultimately, somebody is trying to make a schedule based on assumptions that turn out not to be true, and yet the public, in order for them to fully utilize the marine highway system, they need a dependable schedule. So how does that work?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Ortiz. Yeah, the schedules have been challenging. There's no doubt. You know, we put a draft schedule out for public review, and we take the comments. It's typically, I think, about a 30-day of comment period. And then we have our folks at AMHS that go through those comments. A lot of what we see, and when you get into scheduling, you know, we're trying to plan for events. There's so many events in Southeast Alaska where there's requests for ferry service. You know, and then they also have to work in things like tides and where they're going, you know, and the situation at hand that, you know, you can't go everywhere that you'd maybe like to go just because a ship can go a certain speed. A lot of different factors that weigh into that. Ultimately, you know, it's people doing the best they can to get these schedules written and get out the door. Yeah. I'll leave it at
that. Follow up.
So with that, are you telling me that the person or people that have been in charge of scheduling in the system are now, in fact, continuing to be in charge of scheduling, or is somebody else taking that particular duty of actually scheduling our ferries?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Ortiz, it's a team, you know, because of the different factors that are involved. And even at this latest go-round, you know, we received a FHWA, a civil rights review on how we do scheduling, because they believe that there's some factors that we weren't potentially considering or documenting as we go through and look at services to communities. So it really is a team that looks at it. I mean, there's the people that it factors in the crewing of the ships and the dispatchers, the people that are kind of the experts in how the scheduling can work. The commissioner's office has been involved to talk about what we've heard from the public and the communities that reach out. And then we work together to do our best to come to a schedule that we think we'll serve Alaskans the best.
Last question.
Just for everyone's, we're planning on wrapping up the committee at 3:30, which it is 3:30 right now.
Mine is just a yes or no.
We're going to take this is the last question. I do want to give Representative Ortiz. It's his area, and I understand that. And then we have Representative Tomaszewski is going to finish up with the last question.
And has that scheduling team changed as of recently?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, not that I'm aware of.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Tomaszewski.
Thank you, Coach Johnson. Through the chair to the commissioner. Real quick, in regards to the contracted operational services that you use to supplement your different operations, the contracted snow removal outside the tarmac and the airfield has a $450 increase. Is there a equal decrement on the other side since the tarmac and the airfield folks were doing that snow plowing? The first question, and then do you use any contracted private services for like your wayside maintenance for the cleaning the toilets and taking out the trash?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Tomaszewski. You know, it's hard to make those types of comparisons. Typically what happens to us, we're struggling providing a service, so a lot of times we're authorizing a lot more overtime for our existing staff. And a lot of times, you know, we're burning them out because we're doing so much overtime. The contracting piece comes in as a relief valve for that. We do try to find those parts and pieces where, like, waysides that you can do with that don't intermix things. So you start running into some, you know, challenges with operationally how people coordinate and everything, contractors and state forces. So we consider that. But for the most part, I think we wouldn't be able to make that correlation that we're not spending $350,000 over here because we're contracting out over here. Contractors also have different rate structures, and we bid that work. And so depending on what the bids come in at as well can factor into how much we pay. But we do fit that into our budgets, and they can work into the budgets in different ways depending on the amount of vacancies we have and the vacancy factor, you know, overtime rates, those kind of things.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Brings us to the end of your presentation. That is the last page. We appreciate you very much for being here today. And we have our next presentation will be the FY24 budget overview from the Department of Education and Early Development. That is meeting is scheduled for Tuesday, February 28th, 2023 at 1:30 p.m. Presenting will be Acting Commissioner Heidi Teschner. And then second on the agenda will be a presentation from the Legislative Finance Division on the history of the base student allocation formula. And presenting for that will be our Ledge Finance Director, Alexi Painter. And with no further business before the Finance Committee at 3:33, we are adjourned.